I grew up in Layton, Utah, or Layton, if you're local, and I have a distinct memory of driving down Highway 193 and looking out over the valley to Salt Lake. It was sparkling with light, glimmering and glamorous, and I couldn't wait to move south to the big city. But for all its bright lights, Salt Lake is missing something, a starry sky. This is In the Hive. I'm Emily Means. Light pollution, caused by the excessive use of artificial light, casts its own glow upwards and out, meaning for many city and suburban dwellers, an escape to the countryside is required to see the stars. To remind us what they look like, I asked listeners to share their most memorable experiences with the night sky.
My name is Eric P. Nelson. I am originally from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. My background is in environmental education, so I was teaching for a little nonprofit called the Chewonky Foundation on the coast of Maine a couple years back, where we took public sixth grade classes out on the coast of Maine for a week to camp. And we had a group with a foreign exchange student from China. And every night we would just sit out on the rocks and look up at stars. And he mentioned that, oh, I've never seen stars before. And my brain said, oh, he's never seen this many stars before. And then, no, he said, I've never seen a star before. He had just moved to Maine like the last week. So he came straight from China, where he's never seen a star in the sky, to the coast of Maine, where the sky is just full of stars. And it was the first time that he actually saw a star in the sky. And it just, it was one of those times like, ooh, I enjoy what I'm doing right now. It was a mind boggler, but it was really neat to share that night sky experience with someone so young. And it was awe-inspiring, you know?
I'm Michelle Quist. I grew up in California, Southern California, but I lived in Salt Lake for 10 years now. I remember it so vividly because it was just a few years ago. I was down near St. George in the Kayenta neighborhood of Ivins, Utah, and I was outside in the backyard with my kids, and we looked up, you know, and I was trying to, of course, have this teachable moment, and it was just so awe-inspiring because we could see every star that, you know, we learned about as a kid, the Big Dipper and Sagittarius and the Little Dipper and the North Star. But it wasn't just that they were bright. They were so close. Like, it felt like I could reach out and just touch them. And it brought it closer to, I don't know, not a reality that they're there. You know what I mean? That we're in the same universe. But, you know, living here in Salt Lake, I just don't think about them often because I don't see them. But in this neighborhood, light is, you know, it's in the homeowners association rules to not even keep your porch lights on. And so this one experience I'll always remember because it just seemed like they were just so close.
My name's Patrick Whiting. I'm from Salt Lake City, Utah. A notable night sky experience. Fortunately, I've had many of them, but one that always comes to mind is this evening I had in Japan. I was on a small island called Miyakojima. I was out with a friend of mine. We were just walking along one of the roads, and we decided to stop on, I think it was just a wall. It was just like a simple wall, and we sat down, and the moon was incredibly bright. It was insanely bright. I've never seen the moon brighter than that. It was just like the sun had a small sort of shade put over it, and it was bouncing off of the ocean equally so. It was almost like there was two moons just staring right at you. I don't remember a moon brighter than that one or seemingly larger than that one. I don't know if it was just contextual, but it was awe-inspiring without a doubt. But I didn't feel small. Maybe a better sense would be full, not to play on the fact that the moon was full, but it was sort of it's like a giant pearl. And all I wanted to do was capture as much of it as possible. I took picture after picture after picture. None of them really worked out. It was so bright and the contrast was so strong that I couldn't really get a proper picture of it, which was frustrating in retrospect, but at least I had the memory.
This week, concerned and curious community members met to explore the cause of the disappearing dark in downtown Salt Lake.
So we're going to be identifying the elements of urban lighting design that contribute to sky glow, which is light pollution that obscures our views of the stars at night, and also pointing out fixtures that are fully shielded, which direct light downward and actually help us see the stars better at night while reducing glare that can help us see better and create more safe spaces with less dark places for possible assailants to hide.
This is Betty Maya Foote of the Colorado Plateau Dark Sky Cooperative. Foote led the trek up State Street, down North Temple, and through Temple Square to point out the types of lighting sources that contribute to light pollution.
Here we have fully shielded lights, partially shielded lights right here, and then unshielded acorn fixture type lights. And these acorn fixture type lights actually spew light in every direction, except for where it's useful, which is down below onto the ground.
But they're pretty.
You can't think of them as pretty after you've done this for as long as I have.
Instead of like that, have them be fully shielded like those. But those are actually
the large, tall ones.
You can't see the bulb protruding from below. You want that bulb to be sucked up into the shield, hiding that source of light. But you want it to be a warm color temperature as well. And these are probably a little bit too cool for dark sky friendly lighting.
Foote mentioned that light pollution also affects birds, which depend on light cues to navigate. They become confused by illuminated windows and often collide with excessively lit high-rises. And walking through Temple Square, with the temple beaming to the heavens, Foote said that insects fall victim to the bright lights, too.
Okay, well, last time we were here, there were tons of birds and tons of insects flying around. And I'm not sure if maybe we just can't see them right now. But this is just a great example of some of the unintended consequences of lighting design. This is basically a beacon for insects to flock to. And that changes population patterns and dispersion. Birds, nighthawks who feed on these insects have to fly miles and miles and miles further to get to the insects to feed than they would if they were actually in their natural habitat. Insects are some of the animals that are actually most affected by light pollution, and they're some of the least that we think about. Fireflies are 99% extinct, and that a lot of that comes from habitat destruction from light pollution.
That's Betty Maya Foote from the Colorado Plateau Dark Sky Cooperative. Foote works closely with Stephen Goldsmith, an associate professor at the University of Utah's College of Architecture and Planning and co-director at the Consortium for Dark Sky Studies at the U. I asked Goldsmith to point out some of the biggest contributors to light pollution in Salt Lake City.
Well, ironically, until recently, the University of Utah has been one of the biggest offenders. But we have created a policy up here. We're beginning to adapt our dark sky lighting so that it is fully shielded. So we're making progress. You know, there are so many places in the city where the light pollution emanates. It's really in the aggregate. You think about our street lights that are not fully shielded. And fully shielded means light that is placed directly where we want it to be. It doesn't go out to the sides, and it doesn't go up. If you imagine the kind of sort of light bulbs that we see, those big round night lights that are in a lot of places where the light actually goes up and not down. We still have so many of those. We have them in our parking lots. We have them on our streets. We have them in our big parking lots of the big box stores. And then even in residential neighborhoods, people who have light packs on their garages that shine out as opposed to down. It's really the aggregate of all of these lights that creates the problems of what we call sky glow.
It is bright. Why do we think we need this much light?
I think that the evolution of our consciousness about light comes from a number of different sources, and one is our fundamental fear of the dark. Human beings have always had a fear of the dark. And once we had the ability to illuminate places, we felt that that would provide safety. But as we've gotten brighter and brighter lights that create glare, So if you think about glare, driving on the highway, somebody is approaching you with their bright lights on in their car and how you can't see, that's what we would think of as glare. And there are so many places where we think we're being safer by adding more light, but it's actually making it more dangerous. So the sort of emotional origins are to resolve our fear, to manage our fear, but the practical application of our light has actually created more problems.
How do we measure light pollution? And specifically, you know, Salt Lake is what you might call it a mid-sized city or something. How is Salt Lake doing compared to similarly sized or even larger cities?
There are cities that have policies for their lighting that are actually doing a really good job. And I wouldn't necessarily look at the scale of the city as the kind of commitment to reducing light pollution. So Springdale, Utah is a perfect example of that. Park City, Utah has had lighting policies that keep light to a minimum by and also maximizing security. There are places like Toronto, which is a very large city, that has actually established a program called Lights Off Toronto. And it's a way of helping once or twice a year the community understand that they can actually turn many of their lights off and still have the same amount of safety, but also enjoy the night skies.
So what kind of regulations and policies are in place there? What does that look like? Going to a community council meeting or what?
So I don't know what the process was in Toronto, but I do know in places like Springdale, this was from leadership on the part of the business community that recognized that if they were at risk of creating so much light that people coming to Zion would not be able to see the rich, dark skies that we're known for. So in order to preserve the economic development of the area, they realized they had to start capping their lights. They needed to start creating policies through the Planning Commission, through their mayor and their town council that would create zoning ordinances that require only certain kinds of lighting be used.
Well, as a professor in urban design, and I know that you're, or you seem to be very, very familiar with Salt Lake City, if you were redesigning this city with being light efficient in mind, what would that look like? How would you plan that city?
Well, first of all, it would be done in a way that assures the citizens that their safety is not being compromised. We can demonstrate very clearly that by applying light in just the right places, at the right times of the night, that we can make sure that citizen safety is assured. I would then begin to create policies, not that I could begin them, but would encourage the creation of policies where the city requires only fully shielded lighting, meaning that the lighting is not pointing up but pointing down. So that as we begin to add new buildings or retrofit old buildings, we're beginning to have that kind of light reduction. Light enhancement for safety, but light reduction for sky glow. I would make sure that wherever possible, we have dimmable lights. This is one of the few places where the idea of the electronically smart city makes sense. There are so many times during the evenings where roads have road lights that aren't needed. So having motion sensors, which they're doing in places like Cambridge, Massachusetts, so lights stay dim until they're needed, that's another great example of the kind of policy implementation that we could do. And importantly, when we begin to reduce the amount of light that we see in cities, we're also reducing their lighting bills. So there's a pocketbook effect to these kinds of changes as well.
There's an economic incentive.
Right.
Well, is the Consortium for Dark Sky Studies working with Salt Lake or any other municipalities to reduce light pollution?
Well, we have a number of allies. We're very fortunate here to have groups like the Salt Lake chapter of the IDA that Jess Dwyer has put together. And she is helping work with the metropolitan area to illuminate the challenges, if you'll pardon the pun, of these kinds of problems. We also know that, by example, the University of Utah's shift is significant. We're also beginning processes of educating students about the multiple impacts of lighting, not only on our emotional lives, but on the way that we are ensuring that migrating birds are not disrupted by too much lighting. That's another huge problem. We lose almost 1 billion birds in North America a year because of poorly lit buildings where the birds can no longer navigate. So finding ways to work with what seems to be an increasingly aware city council in Salt Lake City about these kinds of challenges is something that we're doing, again, with groups like the Tracy Aviary, Tim Brown's work down there with Just Wire and others. I think that we are finally getting to a place where people understand that the loss of our access to the night sky is significant. One of the ways that I like to describe this is that one of the crises of our time is a crisis of the imagination, and many people feel that way. And in so many ways, we need to have better creative responses to the challenges that we find. And if we can't look up and see our relationship to the universe and asking ourselves the question, who are we and where are we, I think that we contribute to that crisis of the imagination. So that's another impact of appropriate lighting that I think we need to be focused on.
You know, this seems like a big problem. And as you walk around town, it's not like you as a citizen can go around changing all of the light fixtures. So what do you recommend to people to do in their own individual homes and daily light usage?
Well, one of the things to do is be mindful of the impact that you might be having on your neighbors. When we discuss these challenges with our students, many of them can recall the bright lights from a neighbor's garage or a light that is a safety light that instead of having a motion sensor on, it stays on all night, and how that light literally disrupts their sleep. And we have a lot of evidence that shows the disruption of our circadian rhythms is significant health impact. So I would encourage people to think about the impact that you may be having on your neighbors. Even ask them, are my lights too bright at night? Are there lights that need to be shielded? And then I would begin to respond to that. And then obviously look around our houses and see where we might be able to reduce the way that light trespasses off our property, or maybe amount of light that we are just wasting. Those would be the first kinds of actions that citizens may want to take. Another one would be to have conversations with your community councils, have conversations with your city council members, and talk to them about the great opportunity that we have here to be able to see the night sky again. When I was a kid growing up in Salt Lake, I remember the first time it was a late July night, and I was hearing the crickets, and I was looking up in the trees to see if I could see the crickets, and all I could see were the stars. And I remember the first time that I saw the Milky Way, and how marvelous that was for me as a child. And then sleeping out in my backyard on nights when I could actually see the Milky Way and finding those kinds of connections. If we think about the ways that we can restore our access to the disappearing dark, and the opportunity we have as a growing metropolitan area to make sure we don't lose those kinds of connections, I think that would be a wonderful way to imagine Salt Lake's future.
Stephen Goldsmith from the Consortium for Dark Sky Studies, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for taking the time.
So far, we've looked at light pollution outside, but let's bring the conversation indoors. Dr. Richard Stevens, a professor of community medicine and healthcare at the University of Connecticut, researches the way artificial light, from your fluorescent office lighting to the blue glow of your cell phone, impacts your health. KCPW producer Roger McDonough asked Stevens about the light's effect on the hormone melatonin, which the body produces to regulate sleep.
Maybe where we can start is with the hormone melatonin, which our body produces naturally, and exposure to electric light affects our production of melatonin. How does it do that, and why does it matter?
Before electricity, we had an innate circadian rhythm where we started to transition to nighttime physiology pretty much at sunset. So before electricity, our body temperature drops, melatonin rises in the blood, metabolism slows, we get less hungry, and we start to get sleepy. And that's before electricity. Most of us now light our evenings so brightly and with shorter wavelengths that we delay that transition to nighttime physiology, which is really an ancient part of our physiology. And that is not good for our health. I'm quite convinced of that.
You've pointed out this affects our circadian rhythm. This is the mechanism for our body to recognize that day-to-night cycle that you just described. But what is the danger here? You know, the first obvious thing is that we're going to get a bad night's sleep. And that in and of itself is pretty dangerous. But I understand that there are potentially other pretty serious health consequences. I'm not even certain how to dive into this, Dr. Stevens.
It's a tough, complicated topic. I first got into it because of my frustration with not understanding the pandemic of breast cancer. Breast cancer is much more common in the developed world than in the developing. And it's rising fast in the developing world. And nobody knows why. We thought it was diet. We thought it had to be diet, changes in diet. But it turns out that is not it. We're real clear on that now. And this was back in the mid-1980s, we started to realize it's not diet. So if it's not diet, what else is it? And I thought, well, the hallmark of modern life is the introduction, increasing use of electric light. And so I started to ask my friends around who are experts in various areas, gee, what can light do? And one expert told me, oh, light can suppress melatonin. And I thought, well, so what? And I asked another expert who knew about hormones and cancer, and he said, well, melatonin has been implicated in risk of breast cancer. So I put one and one together and said, well, maybe electric light has something to do with pancreatic breast cancer. And the idea is that melatonin, this was simple at the time. I don't know that it's simplistic, but it was simple when I first stated this in 1987 in a paper. But the idea is light suppresses melatonin, which should be high at night, and melatonin is strongly anti-cancer. We know that from rat experiments. If you feed rats melatonin, they will not get chemically induced breast cancer. But that rats are not people, so we don't know whether that applies. So we had to do a series of studies. We predicted that shift working women should be at higher risk of breast cancer. If light at night causes breast cancer or increases risk, then women who work at night have even more light at night, and so they should have higher risk. And they do. There have been many, many studies of this now.
And when you say shift workers, you mean, you know, people who are, say, cleaning office buildings in the middle of the night.
Night workers, yes. It could even be waiters who work until midnight. But anybody whose work hours include nighttime are getting even more light at night. Now, there's nobody in the modern world goes without light in the evening, electric light. And if it's too bright, and you the electric tablets, smartphones, and that, they have a really bright blue light, and blue light has the biggest effect. We don't have to go without electricity or without light, but what we're doing is it's too bright and it's too blue.
Going back to the kinds of lights that we have, I mean, is there a difference between, you know, the light overhead that is a bright light of a certain wattage, and you fall asleep with that on, versus, again, that screen light that you're talking about now from an iPhone or a tablet or from a smartphone or a computer?
Well, this is the fun and exciting part. Because we're learning more and more about the real basic biology and the engineering of lighting, we're figuring out what kinds of lights we should be using, what time of day. And in the modern world, people not only get too much light at night, they get too little light during the day, because most people work in buildings. So in your home, this is getting more and more sophisticated, but basically I believe this now, and my colleagues who are sort of also expert in this area, I think most of them you talk to will say the same thing. Right now, what a person can do is, if you're in your home or in an office, have a bright, compact fluorescent or LED light with lots of blue in it in the morning. And that sort of mimics the sun. It gives you a real strong signal that this is daytime. It completely suppresses melatonin. It makes you alert and awake. But then in the evening, and really beginning at about sunset, switch to a low wattage incandescent bulb. An incandescent bulb is much less blue. There's a lot more red and orange and yellow in it. And so it has less impact on our circadian physiology. In the evening, if you burnt a candle, candles have almost no effect on melatonin. You can stay in nighttime physiology. At sunset, if you have candles, your melatonin will start to rise as it should. But if you have a bright, compact fluorescent or overhead LEDs, your melatonin will not rise. You will stay in daytime physiology. And that, you mentioned it earlier, that will compromise sleep quality. We know that for sure from carefully done experiments in human beings.
Huh.
But if you have bright light in the evening, your sleep is, even if you have the same number of hours of sleep, it's much lower quality.
This brings me back to the common pastime of so many people in this day and age as they go to sleep, which is, you know, watching Netflix or checking Facebook or doing whatever they do. That, of course, would expose them to the exact kind of light that you say will diminish their sleep quality, may also contribute to other health problems. Breast cancer is one that you're drawing this sort of connection to. Is that a culture shift? How do we prevent against that?
Well, and another part of the fun on this is that the circadian lighting issue is gradually but persistently being taken seriously by the manufacturers now. iPhone, I'm told, I don't have a smartphone.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. But iPhone, I think, has an app called Night Shift. So if you do that, and the first of these was a thing called F.Lux for laptop computers. And it changes the spectrum and intensity of the screen depending on time of day. So if you have an iPhone or a smartphone of any kind, you can use some kind of app that in the evening, it'll make it much less blue and dimmer. That's good.
Right. That sounds good. It sounds like an easy step you can take to help, improve some health outcomes in your sleep. Dr. Stevens, we have limited time here. And so another question that I have is, while you're asleep, all of us have a lot of devices that surround us. So they might come to life mysteriously in the middle of the night because you got a message, or you might have little glowing LED lights or who knows what that are around you at night. How big of a deal is that in your well-being and in your sleep?
Well, I don't want to make a frivolous comparison, but I'm going to. I can smoke a pack of cigarettes in a day and I'll be fine for the rest of my life. It won't shorten my life at all. I'll cough. I won't feel good for a day or two. And I see this as similar in the sense that if we disrupt our circadian rhythmicity one day, no big worries. But if you do that every day, day after day for years, it's going to affect our health. We know that about smoking, of course. But this constant daily disruption of our circadian rhythmicity, I'm quite convinced, is bad for well-being and health. We're not sure about breast cancer, obesity, or diabetes yet. The evidence is mounting. That is chronic circadian disruption from too much light at night. You see what I'm saying? It's not one
sure.
night is not going to kill you, but if it's just daily.
How about, I
was just going to say very quickly, there was a very important study came out a few years ago. It's gotten a lot of press. It compared a backlit e-reader in the evening to a regular book. And the contrast was stark. The two groups had the same amount of sleep, but the sleep quality was much less in the people who used the backlit e-reader because their melatonin was not allowed to increase when it should. Whereas the people reading the book, they were not in the dark, but it was dim enough that their melatonin did go up in the evening.
Well, and you would imagine, while you can't necessarily draw a causation statement about breast cancer or these other things, I'm sure you could say that poorer quality sleep does lead to things like poorer cognition in the day, poorer performance at work or in your sort of general life. That's got to be documented.
Oh, good point. I'm glad you brought it up. Those same studies that looked at the sleep quality also looked at cognitive performance the next morning. And yes, it was impaired in the people with the bright light in the evening.
I wish we had an hour to have this conversation, but thank you again, Dr. Stevens, for taking the time, and hopefully we can talk to you again sometime soon.
Thank you very much, Roger.
What are your best memories of the night sky? Weigh in at KCPW's Facebook page, KCPW 88.3, or feel free to email us at comments@kcpw.org with your feedback and questions. Thanks to the KCPW team for their support of this show, as well as to Andrew Shaw, who produced the show's theme music. And thank you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of In the Hive at kcpw.org. Up next is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Emily Means. Thanks for listening.
When you left me, darling, my world came to an end, and there was darkness on the face of the earth.